The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
And I think one of the things that's happened, especially for the United States, is we've been very comfortable in our logistics. We've assumed it's going to be there, that we can do it so well. We showed that in Persian Gulf. We showed that in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now we're talking about contested logistics.
Yeah.
And that creates a bit of an animal, because the Chinese understand logistics extremely well, because they understand it from the military and from the commercial side. And they're...
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, currently United States Army retired and Dean of the College of Security Studies here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 62, Ships, Shipping, and Power in the Indo-Pacific, with Sal Mercogliano. When we think about maritime power in the Indo-Pacific, we tend to think first about navies, aircraft carriers, submarines, destroyers, and the military balance at sea. But maritime power rests on something much larger. Every day, thousands of commercial ships move the energy, raw materials, and goods that sustain the region's economies. Behind that movement is an entire maritime ecosystem. We're talking about shipyards, ports, merchant marines, and vast logistic networks. Together, they underpin economic strength and national power. And in a crisis or conflict, many of those same qualities, those same capabilities, become essential to moving and sustaining military forces. So are we thinking broadly enough about what maritime power actually means? Today, we're looking beyond the warships to examine the ships, shipping, industrial capacity, infrastructure, and people that shape maritime power and strategic advantage across the Indo-Pacific. And to help us do that, I'm joined by Dr. Sal Mercogliano, a maritime historian, professor, former merchant mariner, and a host of the widely followed What's Going On with Shipping. Sal, welcome to Dialogue.
James, thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness, this has been an amazing few days together. Thank you for being out here at the center.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Any opportunity to come out here, I'm going to jump at, especially being here in Hawaii with you all.
We have done our best to put on the best weather, and so you've got it. I hope you've been into the ocean. I don't know if you have, but...
I was offshore just last night, as a matter of fact. I appreciate it.
Man, that's good. That's goodness. I caught some of your lecture this morning, talking to our fellows. We've got a 117 from 28 countries in CSC 26-3. So they were quite enthralled, as was I, frankly, by the way you presented your lecture today. And so we're now glad. We're glad to have you sit down here. You're a bit of a rock star. No. I'm telling you, you're a bit of a rock star. You've got millions of people who watch your show every month.
Mm.
And your first show that you did after landing here in Hawaii, I actually tuned in. It had just posted about an hour, and I looked and I said, man, there's 20,000 people who have already watched this show in the first hour. And so people listen to what you have to say, and we're glad that you came out here and you said some things with us. And so thank you again.
Well, I'm very fortunate and very lucky, and so I do appreciate it. I think it's nothing me. It's not what I do. I think what I'm talking about shipping, talking about its role, is really important. I think people have a visualization on it now that maybe they didn't have a few years ago. I think there's a whole series of events that kind of brought us to this point we're at today.
Mm. Well, maybe you'll pull on some of those. I heard you tell a few stories this morning, and so maybe I'll prompt some in this hour together. Maybe we'll just talk a little bit, open up talking about this maritime theater.
Sure.
I mean, the Indo-Pacific, I mean, it is defined by vast distances, vital trading routes, and the economies are deeply dependent on the sea. So here's the question. What makes maritime power so consequential here? And do we think too narrowly about it when we focus primarily on navies?
I think on the latter question first, I do agree with that. I do think that we have a mindset, especially in the United States, that sea power is naval power. And in truth, if we go back to the classic Mahanian concept of sea power, It's a little bit of both. The center is named for Daniel K. Inouye. And Inouye is an amazing person. Everyone I've ever talked to in the shipping industry love him because he was an advocate for shipping. I think it's also interesting that he's the only individual who has a U.S. Navy warship, a destroyer named for him, and a commercial ship, a Matson container liner named for him. And I think that's the embodiment of what we should be focusing on in terms of sea power, both the commercial application and the military application. When you come to the Indo-Pacific, I mean, this is an amazing area to talk about. When I talk about maritime history in my courses, I talk about who are the greatest explorers of all time. We'll never know because they were Polynesians who ventured out in small canoes and ventured across the Pacific. Today, we see that same thing. There's massive trade routes. I mean, you talk about the jugular vein of global trade, the aorta. It's got to be that Europe to Asia passage. I mean, 15-20% global trade is moving on that. However, if you look at the global map of shipping, if you look at, you know, where shipping is, that's the blood vessels, it's the circulatory system of global trade. And if you pinch it off, if you close off some of those areas, you can cause damage. And that's what we've seen happen. We've seen it happen in places like the Red Sea. We've seen it in the Strait of Hormuz. And it could easily happen out in the Indo-Pacific. I think we forget how vulnerable it is. And we keep getting reminders of it. We keep seeing that, whether it's Ever Given getting stuck in the Suez, Dolly taking out a bridge coming out of Baltimore, or these geopolitical threats being put by the Houthis and now the Iranians. Shipping is always under threat. And I think for a lot of countries, they start to realize that.
You know, both of those stories you talked about had everybody that wasn't even following shipping captivated because they were consequential. Obviously, people in Baltimore given much thought, and suddenly it affected their lives, and people turned to it. And so I guess I find that you are absolutely right, is that the things that shipping touches is like everything. And things are going well, perhaps we don't notice them, but as soon as there's a glitch in the system, you use the example of an artery or blood flow, and people can relate to that. Maybe we can talk then and understand a little bit more about shipping and power. And so, I mean, commercial shipping carriers, I mean, they're most global trade is going across these things, and yet we often treat it as something separate than national security. But how then might we ought to think about this? How do merchant fleets, shipyards, ports, maritime infrastructure, how does that translate into national power?
When you look at the kind of the classic historical, I mean, you look at the British and the development of the Royal Navy. I mean, it was in conjunction with their commercial fleet. It was hand in hand. I mean, the whole purpose of the Royal Navy was to defend the British trade because it was the British Empire. It's what made the British who they were. It was able to hold off against the Germans in World War I, then in World War II. But we've substantially changed how trade happens. We've done a couple of things. Number one, volume and velocity. We move cargo faster and in greater volume than ever before. 500 million tons at the end of World War II. We're moving over 13 billion tons now. And it's one of the reasons why, when there is a disruption, it's felt so keenly, because it's like hitting a brick wall at 10 miles an hour versus 80 miles an hour. The second element is we changed how we move things. We've created these kind of avenues outside of national interests. We create open registries. So Panama, Liberia, Marshall Islands become the major registries out there in the world. They don't have the navies to defend them, so that when they come under attack, who is going to defend that trade? Is it going to be the US Navy? Is it going to be allied navies out there? We want shipping to be cheap and affordable, but protection comes at a cost. We also don't want to build a lot of resiliency into shipping because, again, we want that kind of affordability. And we saw that during COVID, when all of a sudden shipping was piling up into LA and Long Beach, shipping companies that didn't build a lot of redundancy into them. We love to do that in military, build up logistics and have that. But at times, we don't see that in the commercial side. So that makes it very vulnerable. We talk about maritime choke points. We talk about Malacca and Strait of Hormuz, very, very cognizant maritime choke points. But there are choke points throughout the world that aren't maybe geographic. They could be physical choke points in terms of, you know, created for a reason. I use an example today with ore coming out of Port Hedland in Western Australia going up to China. That creates maritime choke points in the Lombok Straits and the Celebes Sea off of Palawan, off the Taiwan Strait. So we're seeing the dynamics of shipping change. And it's very difficult for government governments, and I would say for militaries to understand that, because there is a detachment from it. We're not as well integrated in, you know, the history of the British. The Royal Navy and the Merchant Marine were kind of symbiotic. They existed together. Many of the merchant officers had commissions. We don't see that as much today. Plus, the U.S. Merchant Marine, much smaller. It's not the number one in the world. It's number 23.
Now, I love that example about the historical British and how their power was part and parcel of their ability to project with commercialism. That makes me think about, you know, China's maritime rise. And I mean, it is built of this enormous capacity across commercial shipbuilding, merchant shipping, ports, naval forces. Let me ask you the question this way then. Should we see these as separate achievements or as an integrated maritime ecosystem? And what strategic advantage then would that ecosystem provide?
I think China sees everything as integrated. I think they have swallowed the man whole and they've really understood that. You go to a Chinese shipyard today and you'll see a massive container ship being built. You'll see a new generation liquefied natural gas carrier being built. And right next door, you're going to see a frigate, a destroyer being built. They understand the kind of symbiotic relationship, very much, you know, cooperative, that they work together. And I think that is something we got away from. We had this idea that maybe we kind of competed against each other. And I'll say this, that was very important for the U.S. to do that at the end of World War II, to create the Cold War environment, to really raise everyone up. It was the greatest rise in wealth per capita around the world. It was a huge achievement to create the trade that we did. We created the Blue Commons, the great blue ocean that was open to everyone. What we're seeing now is challenges to that. We're seeing the emergence of China, who understands that controlling the ocean is more than just having a blue water navy. It's having ports out there. It's controlling every container that's built on the high seas. It's crewing ships, it's licensing ships, it's doing the repairs on ships, being a major factor in the International Maritime Organization that creates the rules for shipping. So China understands how to use soft power, especially in the application of commercial shipping, very well. Every one of their commercial ships have a military application to it. A lot of their crews are trained in what to do in time of conflict. Kind of gotten away from that at the time, you know, World War II, a lot of our merchant mariners understood that. We built ships that had military capabilities built into them. China does that without even thinking.
You know, listening to your talk made me think about the 8 of the 10 largest ports are in this region right here, and most of them actually in China. And these are massive ports. The ability to be able to surge into those and to push out, you know, through those supply lines, the products that they're manufacturing. For those who haven't been to Dali in different places, and they're just massive. And it's just quite almost awe-inspiring to see the degree that they have created this infrastructure. And so when we think about shipbuilding capacity, I mean, ships, I mean, the industrial capacity to build them is worth them. It cannot simply be generated when a crisis occurs. I mean, you have the thing or you don't, but it isn't going to happen overnight. What does the balance of commercial and naval shipbuilding capacity tell us about the maritime competition? And then I might ask you about that. I mean, how can the United States and its allies, its partners, how can they strengthen their collective advantage in this area?
So the U.S. emerges from World War II, and you know it's got the largest merchant marine, the largest navy in the world, which is both a positive and a negative. We built enough ships that we didn't have to build anything for 20 years. At the same time, the rest of the world was in shambles. So what do? We conduct an operation where we give 1,113 ships to our allied merchant marines, repopulate them. We give them the Marshall Plan to let them rebuild their shipyards. And we create the world where we want competition. We want, you know, we don't want to be the dominant merchant marine. We had 63% of global trade in our U.S. bottoms. But we said, no, that's not what we want. We don't want to be the British. We don't want to be the Romans. We want to have this existence out there. So we create this environment where you can get open registries and build ships around the world. And we were good with that because where was shipping being done? It was being done in Europe. It was being done in Japan. It was being done in Korea, allies of our own. But in 1999, we start seeing that kind of thing begin to flip a little bit. 1999, China's building 5% of world ships. They've got 5% of the order book. I had friends who were sailing in the 2000s. They had been on a Chinese ship. It's like, oh, this is not a very good quality ship. 2010s, they're talking a different story. These ships are getting a little bit better. 2020s, This is cutting edge. This is kind of setting a standard right now. But more importantly, China, as of the first half of this year, have 70.9% of all the orders on the globe in Chinese shipyards. And that's at the expense of Europe, which is down in single digits, and more importantly, at the expense of Japan and Korea now. So when we start talking about, well, we can maybe move and build some ships in Japan and Korea are under attack by China. China has built a system in place where they're trying to vertically integrate all aspects of shipping, the financing, shipbuilding, ship repair, container construction, ship-to-shore cranes, port operations, crewing. It is, in many ways, not communistic. It's not capitalistic. It's mercantilistic. It looks a lot like the East India Company in operations out there.
I have been to several of the shipbuilding yards there in Korea. They're extremely impressive. Even recently, we've been out there, and we've got we're taking one of our courses out there early September. The multinational armaments resilient seminar, and so we've got it. And so they'll go out to the shipyards there, and they are impressive. And it's been late '90s since I've been out in Dalian, where the shipyard out there, but. I remember when, those shipyards in Korea and Japan were like king. They were really impressive. And you talked about how coming out of the Second World War, the United States, we forget about how, it's a great book. You probably read it. What is it? Arthur Herman's
Freedom's
Freedom's
Forge.
Forge. Man, that's a fun book to
Yep,
read.
it's a great one.
And it reflects back on the strength and the capacity that we demonstrated during that period. Sustaining the force. Let's talk a little bit about that. So in Indo-Pacific contingencies, getting forces into theater, I mean, this is not only the beginning, I mean, sustaining them across thousands of miles under these enduring challenges. I mean, that's hard. You talked a little bit about this in your lecture earlier today, but so how important are sealift, merchant mariners, commercial shippings, ports, logistics? How important is that to really putting forth a credible deterrence, and do we adequately account for them, those types of things, when we measure real military power?
Well, I think you're dealing, I mean, if what the Indo-Pacific brings is tyranny of distance on a scale that most people don't appreciate. One of the reasons when I do my show, I have a little globe right next to me is because,
We put a Hogan right here for the
well, and you can roll it around and you put the Pacific up there and you understand how big of a honking ocean it really is. And it creates those challenges. I mean, we're seeing that right now, for example, in the Persian Gulf, where, post-World War II, we fought conflicts in Korea. We had a supply base in Japan. Vietnam, we had Subic Bay. Even in the Persian Gulf, Iraq, and Afghanistan, we had Bahrain, we had Oman. What you're seeing right now is the difficulty in sustaining a U.S. naval force 2,200 miles from Diego Garcia. And it's a challenge. It's not that we can't do it. It's just that you need a logistics and sealift force in place to do that. And it's very hard to sustain wartime operations with a peacetime logistics force. And we have made strides at fixing that. I'll give compliments to Military Sealift Command and U.S. Fleet Forces. In the early 2010s, there was a recognition that we didn't have enough oilers out in the fleet. So what did they do? They brought back a concept that we'd used in the past, commercial tankers that can be used to consolidate with MSC oilers. So you can bring a commercial tanker out. We saw it just happen here at RIMPAC a few weeks ago. Bring a commercial tanker out, meet with a U.S. oiler. They can mate up, refuel, and transfer over. Unfortunately, we don't have that for dry goods, for ammunition, for food. And we see that effect on ships like the Lincoln that's out there and at the end of an extremely long supply line. And I think when you look at that, that's a lesson. I did a historical look at me being the historian. One of my favorite times to look at in World War II is early World War II. And I look at the Pacific War and I talk about the six oilers. These are the six fast oilers that sustained the six fleet carriers early in World War II. And I make the argument that the six fast oilers, Neosho and Sabine and all these vessels are as important as Lexington and Saratoga and Enterprise are. And until you get more of them in place, you're really constrained in what your operations can be. And we saw that in early World War II. And you could potentially see that in a modern Indo-Pacific conflict. Without enough logistics, you're going to be constrained. It's the great limiting factor. And I think one of the things that's happened, especially for the United States, is we've been very comfortable in our logistics. We've assumed it's going to be there, that we can do it so well. We showed that in Persian Gulf. We showed that in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now we're talking about contested logistics.
Yeah.
And that creates a bit of an animal because the Chinese understand logistics extremely well because they understand it from the military and from the commercial side. And they're also looking at our lessons learned from previous conflicts.
Pull a little bit more on contested logistics. What you mean by that?
So, no one wants to go toe to toe with a U.S. carrier battle group. There's no reason to do that. However, a U.S. carrier battle group has a finite amount of time on station, fuel, ammunition, food. However, that logistics force, that tanker, that oiler, that supply ship has to bring that material forward. It is the weak point in a potential system. And so, how do you sustain that force, especially when you start going not 2,000 miles from Diego Garcia, but maybe 5,000 miles from California or from Pearl Harbor or from Guam? How do you sustain that force? And that requires a large amount of ships, a large ability to supply. You need shore-based depots. You need that ability. We talk a lot about, tankers. When the Air Force talks tankers, they always talk about aerial tankers. But
Yeah.
some ship tanker has to go to some base and be able to dump that fuel so that aerial tanker can go ahead and refuel. And that's the depth of the Pacific you start seeing. You start seeing how difficult it is to forward deploy that. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing it with the pressure we're feeling on gas and oil in the United States. When California cuts back its refinery process by 19%, that tells us we got to shift how we get gasoline and jet fuel to California. Well, if we're going to pull jet fuel from California to sustain a military operation, if they can't do it commercially now, they can't do it for just normal peacetime operations, how do we do wartime operations? And I think that's why it's really important for leaders and defense leaders in particular to be looking at the commercial aspect. Where are our potential vulnerabilities and what are we doing to prevent gaps and basically an enemy exploiting them?
Thanks for that. That was a bit of a deep dive, but
Sorry.
no. I'm telling you, we don't think enough about this. I really don't think we do. And so I appreciate you, elucidating a little bit about that. My mind was thinking of a lot of relatives, uncles fought in the Second World War, and most of my family, myself excluded, were in the Navy. And so, a lot of stories about the things that you're talking about. We almost have to go back to then to think about the real the degree of fighting that we haven't experienced since then, and when we think about logistics and what it took to sustain all of that. And so, yeah, my mind was reflecting on some of that when you were talking about how the real challenges were.
And one of the things I try to do is highlight when we have moments like this. So a few years ago, the Abraham Lincoln Battle Group was actually in the Persian, it was in the Indian Ocean. And the oiler that was sustaining it, the USNS Bighorn, ran aground. It
Yes,
was
it did.
an accident. But to me, that was a perfect moment to sit there and say, what happens when you lose your logistics? How do you sustain that group? And what we saw is they had to kind of put together a logistics force, kind of cobbled together with other types of ships, commercial ships, to keep that battle group in going. And I think it was a perfect time to say, okay, this could be a wartime. What kind of lesson do we learn from this wartime environment? And you talk about issues like that and it gets attention.
And that oiler was one of the first ships that was repaired here in this region and wasn't sent back to U.S. Shipyard for repair. And so that's pretty interesting. But maritime resilience, let's pull into that. So maritime commerce, I mean, it depends on critical ports, sea lanes, choke points. You spoke a lot about that today, including when we think about in this area, Straits of Malacca. So, what are the Indo-Pacific maritime system's greatest vulnerabilities? I mean, and how might countries make it more resilient or for against these disruptions? So.
So I think the biggest thing that I've noticed over the past few years is how vulnerable shipping is to very small events. It doesn't take much to cause commercial shipping to go astray. And the example of that is the Houthis. The Houthis in the Red Sea. In the span of 2 years, the Houthis attacked 125 ships, maybe inflicted damage on two dozen of them, sank four of them, killed nine merchant mariners. That's in a span when normally 22,000 ships a year travel through that area. What they were able to use is weaponry, some sophisticated weaponry, ballistic missiles and cruise missiles, which are top-line weapons. At the same time, they used aerial drones and surface drones. And we saw the same type of technology being used by Russia and Ukraine. A drone attack on a ship is not going to sink it. It's probably not. You may blow a hole in the side of it. You may damage their engine capability. You may use an aerial drone and hit the bridge and kill some of the crew, or at least intimidate the crew. But probably you're not going to do it. But what you could do is a mission kill. You could knock the ship out enough so it doesn't participate. But it's the knock-on effect. It's the insurance effect. It is, am I going to risk my ship in an area so that if you have a contested area, you have a Pacific Island nation that is in a contested area or something's happening, and all of a sudden a non-state actor attacks a ship that's one of the few ships that provide supply to it, are you going to cause the other ships that do it not to come in? Because as I talk about with commercial shipping, and I've had this discussion with the military, we understand risk differently in the military than commercial does. If you are going to sit there and tell me you have a 99% chance of success, military person is going to jump on that in a minute. That's
That's
a slam dunk. If you're a commercial shipping operator and you say, I have a 1% chance of total destruction, they're going to sit there and say, ooh, I need to mitigate that. How do I mitigate this? Because that doesn't look good. Because I'm not just losing the ship, I'm losing the future revenue of the ship. And you know what? It's better for me to sit back, sit tight with my ship, lose some money for a little while than to lose in the big term. And again, for nations around the Indo-Pacific, what can you do to help offset that? Is there a way to do that? We saw Ukraine come up with a method of self-insurance. We'll self-insure ships to ensure that the grain trade keeps going. So we'll provide that insurance for you so that the ships can keep going. But as we see, there is a breaking point for that, as we just recently reached, as Russia and Ukraine got into a very big escalation in the Black Sea. I think you can see a very similar thing happen throughout the Indo-Pacific. There's a lot of little focal points where trade, you talked about the high points, the Malacca Strait, but there are other areas too where this can be done. I think it's why China is so adamant about having alternative routes for shipping. They want to be able to swing ships different methods. Expansion into the Arctic, for example, is a very interesting one that we're seeing develop now.
I want to pull a little bit. You just mentioned about drones and the vulnerabilities that ships can have on this. And I heard you talk about this today. And so maybe you might just share a little bit about what some of the actions are being taken to try to counter some of the drones that they're worried about attacking ships.
Sure. I mean, it's a very big asymmetric threat. So, for example, on the surface drones, which are nothing more than speedboats that are remote control. I mean, the Houthis develop these boats where literally they drive them out, jump overboard from them, and then they visually remote control them into the side of the ship. And, it doesn't take much to stop them, but you need crews on board, armed crews to be able to stop them. You need to bring the weaponry sufficient to do that. But what we're seeing right now, for example, in the Black Sea, where there's been this proliferation of drone attacks, I mean, the Ukrainians have attacked over 200 ships. You're seeing ships' crews adopting drone, anti-drone defenses. I showed an image today of a ship draped with this huge, massive net. And it's not to catch the drone, it's to cause the drone to detonate a little further away from the bridge. Hardening of the bridge, putting kind of literally sandbags and these large pallets around the bridge to defend the bridge to make sure you don't lose crew members. And what we see right now on social media is multiple attacks on ships. You'll see the crews all the way up on the bow of the ship filming because they don't want to be near the superstructure because they know that's the target for it. And the other fear you have is will crews balk at doing this? That are they going to, because that's the other liability. Is it worth my life to be shot at in the middle of this circumstance? How do you defend against these drones? We're seeing that even with U.S. defense in Strait of Hormuz, we're still seeing ships hit about every couple of days. So it's a very tough element to do. It's and we saw it in the Red Sea too, where the U.S. staged two large military operations, and even the U.S. military acknowledged they can't get 100% success. And if you can't get 100% success, shipping companies are going to go, okay, well, we're going to go somewhere else, and this is going to affect your economy. This is going to affect business. What's the kind of the impact of it? And that's the big player. I think people are realizing now they can do more to interdict shipping than ever before, and it has massive repercussions on global economy.
And you put out the numbers at the beginning of the show. I mean, you said like 13 billion tons of shipping going on annually now, right? And compared that to the 70s when it was, I don't know, 2.5 or three, maybe a billion tons. And I think your projections even higher than that going forward.
Oh, yeah, you're looking at 2030, somewhere in the range of about 15 billion tons. But what we are seeing is a slowing down. I mean, this is really interesting, is since COVID, we've seen global trade slow down. When global trade slows down, global economy slows down. And that's because of a lot of the disruptions. Obviously, COVID caused a big one, but we're also seeing it with disrupting of shipping. One of the things we're seeing is it's taking longer to deliver cargo, what we call ton miles. How many tons does a, you know, how many miles does a ton of cargo have to go? And it's normally about 4,500 ton miles. So about 4,500 miles for every ton. Now it's up to over 5,000. And that means you're redrawing maps on the world. You're redrawing that artery system. You're creating new networks. Maybe it's not that network going from Europe to Asia through the Suez, but around the Cape of Good Hope. And now that becomes the major network for us. Or we're redrawing a system where out of China, you're going eastward through the Panama Canal. Didn't talk about it today, but you know, right now Panama Canal is suffering low waters.
Yes, it is.
They've announced that they're going to have to curtail numbers. I walk around with a app on my phone that gives me the water level at Gatun. I really need to get a life because that's the app I have on my phone. But that has a huge ramification because what we're seeing is if countries are drawing oil, for example, from the United States because we're not getting enough out of the Persian Gulf, can we supply our allies with oil? We're seeing interesting defense arrangements being taken place. The UAE, during the height of the attacks in the Persian Gulf, brokered a deal with South Korea for anti-drone defense. In return, their state shipping line, ADNOC, is going to provide oil directly to South Korea so that South Korean refineries stay up. And you know, Australia running low on gasoline, you can see the impact that these disruptions have.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So here's a challenge that you just spoke about. Let's talk now about collective advantage. And so the maritime balance is not simply the United States versus China. Allies and partners, I mean, they bring geography, ports, shipbuilding, commercial fleets, and military capabilities. So here's the question. How significant is that collective maritime capacity, and how can allies and partners translate it into strategic advantage?
Well, I think number one is if you're a large trading partner, you're a big nation, you obviously have a lot of pull when it comes to shipping. You can do a lot. If you're the US, China, obviously you have a lot of pull. When you're a smaller nation, you have less pull. And I talked a little bit about this today, where countries, especially toward the end of a supply line, don't have a lot of pull. But I think collectively, if you can bring nations together on trade agreements, especially in trade agreements with commercial shipping lines, making deals with these larger shipping lines for potential services for businesses, then you can secure better assets, better reliability for shipping. The problem you have right now is a lot of disruptions. We see that when there's a disruption at one end of a supply chain, it resonates through the entire chain. And like, for example, during COVID, we saw this massive dislocation of smaller container ships that normally provide what we call feeder service. They're the ones that come out of those central hubs and deliver the cargo to all the smaller ports. You really need a system in place where you could collectively negotiate with shipping firms to put more strength behind that. And I think we talk so much about defense, but we're not talking enough about the commercial aspects. Because I think that the Asia Pacific area, particularly Indo-Pacific, is an area that is growing in trade beyond just the normal routes. I had an opportunity while I was here to sit in on a working group with the Papua New Guinea. And very interesting, there's a major trade route that runs, that bisects right through them. They're trying to kick up a fusion center, bring together the different groups together to communicate. And I talked about the fact, like, well, here you have a trade route runs right through the center of your country. Who are the shipping firms that are in there? What companies are shipping on there? How can you communicate with them to say, listen, this will benefit you? You know, this fusion center, because we can ensure more reliability, safer shipping routes. What can we get from you to contribute to this? Could it be intelligence? Could it be money? Could it be resources coming in and better able to identify that? And I think that's an area where when groups come together, especially here, and they talk, they can see how different areas are developing.
Yeah, thank you for talking to the Papua New Guinea cohort on that. They are committed to getting this National Maritime Fusion Center, but it is a lot. There's a lot to pull in all this and
It's fascinating because even in the US, it's very difficult. You know, I
yeah.
mean, communication between agencies, governments, very difficult to do. And even more difficult when you go outside the government to talk to commercial firms and their businesses because they're very proprietary. They don't like to talk. But if you can show interest for them, you can kind of get buy-in from them.
Let's think about the future of maritime power. Technology is changing. It's changing ships and warfare. But maritime power, I mean, it still depends on the industry, the infrastructure, the people, the logistics, partnerships. When you look 10 or 20 years in the head, what will ultimately determine maritime advantage here in the region?
I think technology is rapidly advancing. We're seeing proposals for changing on the way we move goods. I don't think the container goes away. I don't think the super tanker goes away. I think we're pretty much locked in to those modes of transportation. But new fuels are a very interesting idea. You know, how do we move things more efficiently? Talked about some alternative fuels today. One that I didn't mention, which is a really critical one, small modular nuclear reactors. Really big topic right now. Being brought up. This is a fuel system that doesn't just fuel ships, but it can actually feed into grids when those ships are in port. Very important. I think, especially when you're talking about net zero, with so many countries worried about climate, worried about carbon emissions, worried about dumping of toxics in their area, that's a big issue that we want to talk about, is how that plays in. I think the other element we have too is this system of autonomy. Autonomous shipping is coming in. How do we reduce crews on ships, make crews more efficient? I mean, one of the things that has changed in shipping from when I started the ship to the way shipping is done today is ships don't sit in port at all. The goal, if I'm a shipping company, I don't want my ship sitting in port. I want it moving all the time. So the amount of time in port is minimal. I want to maximize my efficiency, and so I want to keep that ship moving at all time. Crew is a great variability, both for availability of the crew and the cost. And so autonomy allows me to start bringing that crew down. However, autonomy means I need to link up. I need controls. I need to be able to do it, which exposes the ships to potential cyber attacks and vulnerabilities. So I think the region has to start looking at what does it want in terms of security for its ships? Does it want, you know, in other words, safer ships operating, which means greater control, which means greater cost associated with that? Because we've seen some great tragedies too. I mean, let's, you know, one of the things we see, unfortunately, is huge oil spills. Got one going on right now off of Oman. We've seen tanker explosions in the anchorage off of Malaysia, ferry disasters in the region. Obviously, we want to see better control because I think that creates better shipping and, more importantly, more security.
You today were talking about one of those cyber attacks with a Maersk company. Remember being in Denmark, and they got a beautiful headquarters. Maersk does, and most people don't realize the breadth and scale they have. Neither do they realize the cyber attack and how dangerous it can be against shipping companies. And you spoke a bit of because of, you know, they operate on you know, open net, as it were, but maybe you might just kind of elucidate a little bit about the real vulnerabilities when you say cyber attack again, and what you're thinking about.
So cyber is a major issue in shipping. Shipping, especially a modern container ship. Look at a modern container ship, 20,000 boxes. That requires intricate control, how you load it, how you offload it. You can't do that on paper and pen. You can't even do that on a spreadsheet. This is computer control. AI is moving these containers. And in 2017, Maersk was susceptible to an outside threat. It uploaded a virus, NotPetya, which was actually a Russian virus developed by the GRU that was meant to target Ukraine. Wasn't meant to hit Maersk, but Maersk, because they did business in Ukraine, uploaded this, and it proliferated through their network. And unfortunately, once it got through the initial firewall, there weren't firewalls to contain it at that point. So every ship, every agency, every mechanism of Maersk, except for one office in Lagos, Nigeria, that had a power outage and couldn't get power back up, its mainframe was the only one that wasn't infected and therefore was preserved. But when it hit, it was designed not to ransomware, but to destroy. So it blanked everything out. And fortunately, at the time, there was an excess capacity of shipping, so other shipping firms were able to step up at the expense of Maersk, but it cost Maersk $10 billion. It's the largest cyber attack in history. And this is a vulnerability that we see in shipping because it's very susceptible to that, because you have to be able to track containers. I'm a shipper, I want to know where my stuff is, I have to access that. I may have to transship it at points. And so therefore you have that kind of vulnerability. And we see it not just on shipping, but on the port side, on the regulation side, on the inspection side. Because all of that has to be documented. A lot of stuff is done prior to that where ships are sending information in. They have to be cleared for quarantines, cleared for inspections. And this is a vulnerability we see across shipping. A massive cyber attack on the port of Houston took place. And throughout the Indo-Pacific, I would argue that a lot of ports don't have the protection that they need to have. Plus, we're dealing with ships carrying vast quantities of hazardous materials. And what we've seen is an expansion of fires on board ships, lithium ion batteries on container ships, and car batteries on car carriers. And as I mentioned today, nations like Sri Lanka and India can wind up with a ship burning off its coast. And if they don't have the resources available to counter that, then you're going to have an environmental damage. And to me, many of the smaller Indo-Pacific nations are much more vulnerable to that, especially in their very environmentally kind of potentially damaging areas.
Yeah, when I heard you first tell that story, I hadn't contemplated how severe it could be, but you laid that out well and give people reason to be a little bit more conscious with in their areas of cybersecurity, and then just understanding what vulnerabilities there are. We got a live audience. We've got a lot of people that have signed in and submitted questions. So let's take some of those. And so this first question is going to ask us about the Jones Act. And you might even need to maybe give a little explanation of what we mean when we talk about the Jones Act. But it's saying, does the Jones Act strengthen or constrain U.S. maritime competitiveness here in the Indo-Pacific?
Sure. So this is the third rail of shipping.
It is.
Most people don't like to touch it. I grab it with both hands. But I think we need to have a dialogue and discussion about it. So Jones Act, in the context of the United States, refers to Merchant Marine Act of 1920, specifically cabotage, Section 27, which says to move goods from one U.S. port to another, you have to be U.S.-owned, U.S.-flagged, U.S.-built, and U.S.-crewed. Come to Hawaii, you'll see U.S. tugs and barges moving between the islands, and they fit that category. You can't have a Chinese-owned, Chinese-built, Chinese-flagged ship doing that. You can have ships come into your port and offload. You can even have your ships come and move through other ports at the same time. They just can't move American goods. And this has created a lot of issues. I would argue that cabotage is an interesting discussion that we need to have, right? And not just us, all countries need to have it. Because what we see is the creation of these massive corporations. When you look at shipping firms today, these are not tiny shipping firms. We're talking about behemoths. When you talk about Maersk, you talk about HMM, you talk about CMA CGM, you talk about Mediterranean Shipping Company, which is the largest container liner in the world. That is a company that has really no check and balance on it. It's not even stockholders in the company. It's owned by a family. And one of the things I think about the Jones Act is, should we have a dedicated group of ships committed to the U.S. coastal trade? And I think a lot of countries should ask themselves that question. Do you want portions of your trade just completely outside your hands? And what we're seeing is some countries are looking at this. Australia is having this discussion right now. Should we create a national sealift fleet? India is taking a look at this. Should we create some sort of domestic fleet? And I think we need to have a dialogue about it. Maybe the U.S. build requirement, we could talk about that, is an interesting one that we need to have a dialogue on, because U.S. build has been a big issue in the United States. But should we have a core component? Do you want to outsource your basically port-to-port operations? And what we're seeing right now is, because of the disruption at Hormuz, we've seen Jones Act waivers being put into effect in the United States. Matter of fact, it's the longest Jones Act waiver ever in the history of the United States. Somewhere in the range of 60 million barrels of oil have been moved internally within the United States on foreign flagged ships since its inception.
Well, since you mentioned the build requirement, let's take one more question in this area here. And so this one is asking about, should the Jones Act U.S. build requirement, I mean, should it be reconsidered for non-contiguous U.S. states and territories?
Well, I think we need to have that discussion. The problem with the Jones Act is this: there are those who are in favor of the Jones Act and those who oppose the Jones Act, and they will never agree, ever. They'll sit on their mountaintops and not take a step off. And I always say there's some sort of medium in between. I don't think repeal solves the problem. At the same time, 100% retention of the Jones Act has done nothing but seen the decrease of the U.S. Merchant Marine over my life. And so I think we need to have a discussion. And one of the most interesting ones, and we're starting to see that, Hanwha, Hyundai are getting involved in U.S. shipping. Hanwha which bought the old Philly shipyard.
Schuylkill,
And what we're seeing is shipbuilding being done there. And very interestingly, you go to the Hanwha Yard in Korea, they're building a ship a week. You go to the Hanwha Yard in Philly, they're building a ship a year. And it's like, how can we bring some of those elements together? And do we need to start changing it? Do we need, for example, to build 10 new tankers in the United States? Maybe the first three are built in Korea, but in the meantime, we ramp up Hanwha to build the next seven. And those three that are built in Korea are waived under a provision to operate in the coastal waters because we're getting the seven that are built in the U.S. I think those are the dialogues. And we're seeing that with things like icebreakers in Finland, the Finland icebreakers with the Coast Guard, which isn't Jones Act, that's a government.
That's right.
And so I think we're also having discussions about warships being built overseas. I think we need to understand that ships are built differently today than ever before. You're more of an assembly yard than a true fabrication yard today. So can we bring modules, components from other places? For example, do you want to start a propeller business in the United States? That's really expensive. It's really cost, prohibitive. Meanwhile, Germany builds the best propellers in the world. Why can't I just use German propellers on my Jones Act ship? And we get a waiver for that or a provision for that because that's an efficient method. And in the meantime, we can start seeing about developing a propeller industry in the United States.
When you talk about being an assembly line, reminds me of Kaiser. I mean, that was how he was so successful in putting out so many ships in the Second World War, is because it was almost bringing in components and putting them together, but because they put out so many.
And the irony thing of Freedom's Forge is the chapter that's not written that needs to be written after that, which talks about post-World War II, is the Kaiser yards get closed down, the traditional yards remain open using the past method of shipbuilding. Meanwhile, the Kaiser method is adopted overseas in Japan, Korea, and Europe, and they take benefit of what we had developed. So it would have been almost better if we'd shut every yard in the United States and started over in 1945.
You talked about Korea, so let's just go a little bit further here. The U.S. ROC shipbuilding. This is the question that the audience is asking. How promising is U.S. ROC shipbuilding cooperation for strengthening America's military maritime capacity?
Well, I think it's important to understand that Korea and Japan have a ulterior motive here. They are under attack by China. I mean, they are losing shipbuilding capability to China. So it's a very important capability for them to want to come to the U.S. And I think allied shipbuilding is very important. I think we can learn a lot from the Korean shipyards. I mean, just for example, one of the problems in U.S. shipyards is we have a sole source customer. It's the U.S. government, largely the Navy. And the Korean shipbuilding has a very interesting mantra when you go to a Korean shipyard. For example, if you want to change something on a ship being built, congratulations, you'll wait till the ship is built and then you can fix it. Whereas in the US, we will change anything you want. And it's like, that's a very interesting mindset. Can that work in the US? I'm not sure, but I think there are provisions. One of the things I love is a study that showed that welders in Korea, 100% of their time is welding. In the US, it's about 50 to 70% because the other time is spent on paperwork. What can we do to make it more efficient? I'm a college professor. I'm going to tell you right now, I can get a high school graduate a great job right out of high school without a college degree. There are jobs out there that you can jump into. And I would say this, I can even get you a better job if you're a college graduate for 4 years. You want to go get your hands dirty in a shipyard for a few years. You can pay off your student loans and then you can figure out what you want to do. I think we need to take those lessons between us and Korea. I think Korea needs us. We need Korea. We need to understand that. My fear is I don't like when we're doing the Ships Act, I wanted ships for America. I'm not sure I want ships for Korea. I want Korea to benefit, but I want us to benefit. And I think it is, there's plenty of room for reciprocity here for us both to develop and for new shipyard entities to exist too. Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, India. Those are countries that are trying to develop nascent shipbuilding capabilities. And I think, one country is not going to challenge China in terms of shipbuilding, but many countries working together can do that.
Well said, well said. Let's take this next question and a little bit further south from where we were just talking, and this one's to American Samoa. So the question is, how should the United States strengthen its maritime presence in American Samoa?
Well, I think American Samoa or any of the U.S. territories and areas should be more integrated into trade. We should do more to incentivize trade between those areas. I think we do need to eliminate barriers. It is cost prohibitive under the Jones Act to ship because it's American crews, American, and we tend to pay a little bit more. That can be offset. We can find offsets to that. It could be tax refunds, could be tariff-free shipping to move in there. We really need to integrate more into that. And so I think for American Samoa could become that nexus hub for potential shipping. If we could work on US shipping, create those areas where you can bring centralized ships in and then use it as a kind of spoken hub method, then maybe a place like American Samoa can help develop that. I think that's an area that has a lot of potential to work for the United States in terms of trade.
This next question is going to take us to the Philippines. So, how can the Philippines leverage its location, its shipbuilding workforce, its the mariners? I mean, just in order to strengthen its maritime position.
I think the Philippines, number one, is in a strong position to begin with. I
Okay.
mean, the most common mariner in the world is a Filipino mariner. They're prevalent everywhere. Their maritime academies, their maritime schools. I mean, you see Filipinos everywhere. Their position is absolutely crucial. I think one of the reasons why China challenges them so much is because Chinese trade literally goes through Philippine waters, through their EZ, and they're cognizant of that. Whether it's the Southeast China trade going through Malacca Straits to Middle East and Europe, or that trade heading due south, heading toward Australia. Talked about the fact that 5% of global trade follows this little kind of network from Port Hedland all the way up to China. This is raw earth. Literally the raw earth being scooped up, iron, copper, lithium, you name it, is going in. So I think the Philippines has a potential to really develop. One of the things that they have to do is develop the other components necessary for things like shipbuilding, steel, financing, the electronics. This is where China has the advantage because they're able to bring all those materials together. The US has them. The problem is they're scattered, they're spread, and they're not able to scale up to volume. That's what China has been able to do. I think the Philippines needs to look at that. And I think if the Philippines, again, stable governments, create the model for investment. How do you bring that commercial investment into the Philippines? And you see that Korea goes into the shipyard there, start developing the old Subic Bay. I think that's what they want: stability in government, stability in the potential for resource management and for profitability will get that happening. And you're going to see it in Vietnam, you're going to see it in the Philippines, you're going to see it in Indonesia.
This next question is going to take us to looking at France. And so it's asking about U.S.-France cooperation. So where could greater U.S.-France maritime cooperation make the biggest difference here in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, I mean, you look at that French EEZ. Again, this is something that most people don't understand is the size of the EEZs that exist out in this region. And that becomes extremely important, whether it's for fishery enforcement, whether it's for underwater mining or submarine cables. Very important. France has a capability with its colonial background, excuse me, colonial background to talk to a lot of countries. And I think the US has to be able to develop that themselves. France has the capability, unlike many other nations, to project power. We saw that with the Charles de Gaulle battle group being able to come out. I think France can have that capability to potentially lead other areas in that. I think, much like many other countries, we need to be invested in the Indo-Pacific because this is where trade is going to start developing even more. We're seeing that happen, we're seeing those chains move out. We're seeing more growth in the area, seeing population growth, seeing financial development in the area. And again, as countries start coming up economically, trade starts growing more with them. And I think France has that capability to do that historically in the region.
This next one's going to ask us about choke point lessons. So it says, what can choke points like the Strait of Hormuz, what can it teach us about maritime vulnerabilities here in the Indo-Pacific?
I think one of the biggest ones, and I take this lesson from the Strait of Hormuz. Everybody understood Strait of Hormuz. Everybody understood the potential vulnerability of the Strait of Hormuz. And I think one of the things we're seeing right now is how vulnerable straits are to operations less than we thought. We thought, okay, the shutdown of strait, you've got to mine it. You've got to, saturate it with missiles. And in truth, what we see is it doesn't take that much. The Houthi demonstrated that. The Houthi threat was very much, once you eliminate the ballistic and cruise missile threat, you still have the drone threat, and it doesn't take that much, which means that choke points now are out there. The other element too is with choke points is I would argue you can create choke points. You can do that. One of the things we saw in the operations being done out in the Indian Ocean was the U.S. Marine Amphibious Ready Groups, first based on the Tripoli, second based on the Boxer, were able to interdict trade. This blockade, I think, is going to be looked at in a much different way in how you exert economic coercion against different states. Sanctions. The sanction regime is another element that we're looking at here, the creation of the dark fleet and how these fleets operating outside the bounds of normal shipping are being done. I think they're a big threat to a lot of nations out there, but they're also potential sources for some countries to use to get around choke points. And again, the traditional choke point isn't what we always think it is. We tend to look at very high volume, high velocity cargo moving through these choke points. But if you're Papua New Guinea, that choke point is right off your northern coast of New Guinea and New Britain. I mean, that's a valuable choke point for you. And if that gets choked, that hurts their trade tremendously. So, I mean, we need to be looking at it, and the countries need to do a real assessment on their vulnerabilities. We saw the closing of a U.S. port because of the Dali incident. That can happen tomorrow in almost any country around the world. Some countries only have one or two major ports. What happens if that happens? If that had happened in LA or Long Beach or Houston, it would have been catastrophic for the United States.
This next question is asking about Southeast Asian sea power. How can Southeast Asia littoral states better leverage maritime power to protect their national interests?
Well, I think, number one, I think we're all seeing the values of navies right now more than ever before. I think because of these attacks on shipping, everybody understands having a presence on the ocean is extremely important. And again, I don't think you need, Arleigh Burke-class destroyers and Ford-class aircraft carriers, but you do need presence out there. So I think for a lot of Southeast Asian nations, they're looking at that. How do we get that presence out there and provide some sort of support, some sort of control, and more importantly, to deter aggression against it? I think visualization is very important. I also think monitoring the shipping going through the area, you can't rely anymore on simply AIS because it's too easy to spoof. It's too easy to hide. You can turn it off. You do need visualization out there. And so presence out there using auxiliaries in some ways. The Philippines will use fishing boats to identify vessels. They'll get crews out there to be able to do that so that you can enlist and see who's operating in your EEZ, who's operating in there, particularly when you're dealing with fishing fleets, when you're dealing with groups coming in that maybe are moving illegal drugs or personnel. You want to be able to see that. So I think for nations, they really need to be able to use all the assets at place. I work with a group that does monitoring of tankers. They use open source intelligence. They use cameras set up at key choke points. They use overhead satellites. And they basically are able to visualize the deck of every tanker in the world and through AI identify exactly who it is so that if you're trying to smuggle oil out, you can very quickly identify it and tell a potential buyer, don't buy that load because it's coming under a sanction. And if that gets caught, you're going to be under US or whoever's sanction is.
Let's take just one last question
Sure.
then. This one's asking about international straits. Where do disputes over passage through international straits pose the greatest strategic risk?
Well, I think the biggest issue here is a couple of things. Number one is UNCLOS and the ambiguity we do have in certain areas of it. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, obviously the US has not ratified it, which I think is a big error. I think we should. I think the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea does not provide answers to everything. It is a less than 200-page document that does not do everything. However, one of the most important things is the idea of innocent passage and transit passage. That has got to be something that not just the United States, but all the nations of the world are in favor of. No nation should control a strait that chokes off another nation's ability to get to the oceans. And I worry at times that this is the new challenge. I talk about this in my channel. Excuse me. That one of the things we're seeing right now, and we hadn't seen this since world wars, is a challenge to freedom of the seas. And I think that challenge is out there by both nations and groups who are basically making the argument that, listen, you put a flag on the back of your ship, you properly register, you properly insure, you properly classify, you should be able to sail the oceans and conduct peaceful trade and transfer. That's not what's happening. We're seeing ships being attacked, seeing it in the Black Sea, we're seeing it in the Red Sea, we're seeing it in the Strait of Hormuz, Persian Gulf. And what I fear is it expands to the biggest arena on the planet, the Indo-Pacific area, where we start seeing attacks on ships by groups that maybe have a problem with the government or want to entice some other reason. And unfortunately, commercial shipping is a very ripe target. They're large, they're massive, they get a lot of attention very quickly, and they cause economic influence, but they're just enough detached that it doesn't cause a huge backlash like an airliner would do. And we kind of saw that in the 2010s with Somali piracy triggering it up, but it wasn't enough to do it. But now it's starting to change. And that's my big fear, is this challenge on freedom of the seas.
Oh my goodness, Sal, this has been an amazing hour together. I am so much better because I've spent it with you. And so thank you for that.
You're very nice, James. I appreciate that.
So we typically close by asking our guests to, for recommendations. So let's do this one a little bit more unique. I mean, tell us about what's going on with shipping and why the audience might be interested in that, your podcast.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I talk about what's happening with shipping. It's a very simple name, and it kind of explains what I do. One of the things about shipping is we don't see it too much. One of the things that we've created, if you live in the United States, for example, is shipping really isn't in our mindset. You know, back in the day, you would have freighters pull up downtown in the port. You would see ships. You may know someone who's involved in shipping. Today, it's very detached. The shipping ports are kind of off the beaten path, and it's very seamless. We don't see it happening, and I think one of the things I like to do is make people come, aware of what shipping is, and not just the disasters or the accidents that happen, but how we are so dependent on this shipping all the time. The men and women who are involved in it. Again, we talk about the idea that the entire human economy is based on the fact that 1.5 million merchant mariners move roughly around 100,000 ships around the planet every day. And that's a very small percentage of the overall population. Yet if they didn't show up for work and didn't do what they do, the global economy comes to a screeching halt. And, much like anything else, we get very, very comfortable and dependent on things, and we don't think about it. But every now and then, what we're seeing is a lot of visibility on incidents that are creating problems. And I think understanding whether it's Ever Given in the Suez, whether it's Dolly hitting the bridge in Baltimore, whether it's the Houthi or the Iranians attacking shipping in the Strait, it's really important to be able to get some context. And what I like to think I do, and I don't know if I do it well, James, but is just sit there and kind of make it understandable so that if you're a CEO of a company, you're a military leader, or if you're just living in central Kansas, you understand why shipping is so important to you.
Well, Sal, several million people a month watch your show, so I think they probably think you're doing it pretty well. And so thank you for being on this one. We hope to have you back next time you're on Hawaii.
I hope to be back soon.
Thank you. Maritime power is about far more than the ships we see at sea. It rests on the shipyards that build them, the ports that support them, the merchant mariners who sail them, and the logistic networks that sustain them, both the economies and military forces. And in the Indo-Pacific, the ability to bring those elements together with allies and partners will remain an important source of economic strength, deterrence, and strategic advantage. My thanks to Dr. Sal Mercogliano for helping us look beyond the warships and better understand the maritime ecosystems that underpin power in the Indo-Pacific. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us. These conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, and until next time, aloha hoi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.